40 years ago today, oil started flowing down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The pipeline wasn't just any project. It required tens of thousands of workers to lay 800 miles of pipe, which had to withstand Arctic conditions, earthquakes, and mighty rivers. It took 3 years to build, and in the process, it turned Alaska upside down. We'll talk about the pipeline today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Building the pipeline was an incredible engineering feat, and the building boom it required transformed Fairbanks and many other Alaska cities. Today's Talk of Alaska is part of a larger series at Alaska Public Media on the pipeline called Midnight Oil, including a new podcast that launches today. To hear the incredible story of how Prudhoe Bay was discovered, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe to Midnight Oil wherever you get your podcasts. Today we're talking about how the pipeline was built and what that boom meant for Alaska, and we have two people who were there to tell the story. Dave Haugen was a project manager with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, the company that managed construction of the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thanks so much for being in the Anchorage studio with me. And Dermot Cole is a journalist and the author of Amazing Pipeline Stories, How Building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Transformed Life in America's Last Frontier. Thanks for joining us, Dermot.
It's good to be here, and look forward to this.
Yes, Dermot joins us through the magic of radio and a great connection from our friends at KUAC in Fairbanks. You can also join our conversation. What's your pipeline story? Did you help build it? Did you survive the boom time in Fairbanks, Valdez, or any other place along the route? How did you survive it? We want to hear your stories. Give us a call statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Dave, let's start with you. Tell us about how you got the job as project manager on the pipeline.
Well, I first became involved on the pipeline itself in 1970, and I was back in Alaska after I'd had my tour of duty with the U.S. Army and wanted to be on the project. At that time, the original survey work was starting. So I was lucky to get on board with a survey crew, and we did the survey from Valdez up to the Yukon River. That was the half of the alignment that we were in charge of. So for over a year, I was out in the field, hopscopping from one place to another and staking out the original pipeline alignment. That concluded in 1971, and then the pipeline, as far as the field work was concerned, kind of went into a dormant stage. The engineering work was still continuing in places like Houston, but field work was not ongoing. Luckily for me, one of the people that I had worked for in the surveying arena was involved in the startup of the actual construction work, and he got a hold of me and asked if I was interested in joining Alyeska directly for the construction effort. So in the early summer of 1974, I was hired by Alyeska Pipeline, sent originally down to San Francisco to Bechtel's home office to do design reviews of the pipeline, but just in a matter of weeks was transferred up and became part of the haul road construction. I was based at Five Mile Camp, which is obviously 5 miles north of the Yukon River, and in a very short period of time, we constructed the haul road from the Yukon River all the way to Prudhoe Bay. In just over 150 days of construction work. After that, I was moved to Old Man Camp, was in charge of the Section 4 operations. It was based there for about a year, then transferred down to Delta Camp, was in charge of Section 2, which is based there. And then finally in 1977, I was in charge of the final turnover of the pipeline from the Yukon River down to Valdez. We turned it over to operations. And then, as we all know, what we're celebrating today is the startup of the oil through the pipeline at that time.
So you were there from, wow, the very, very beginning, from surveying the route of the line. What was your experience, your work experience before that, that really, or did it prepare you for what the next several years would bring?
Well, as far as surveying goes, I was actually in Alaska in the mid-60s when I was still going to university, getting my engineering degree. So I came up 3 summers in a row to be out on field surveys at that point in time, which was, I have to say, a time when Alaska was a totally different state. Mm. It was prior to the discovery well at Prudhoe Bay in 1968. And so it was a much reduced time as far as the economy was concerned, the type of construction techniques, things of that sort.
Sure.
But after I came back to Alaska, became part of the survey crew, I was very fortunate that kind of became the springboard from which I could jump into the project management world.
Dermot, you moved to the Fairbanks area in 1974, right at the start of the building boom. What was that like? Were you a reporter then at the Fairbanks Daily News Miner?
Well, when I moved here in 74, Lori, I was attending the University of Alaska. And so spent most of that time, you know, as a student. I also worked part-time. I did not go to work on the pipeline. I think I made one half-hearted attempt, but when they told me I needed a residency card, I sort of said, okay, forget it. I drove a cab for a while, and I worked as a janitor and went to school. I finished my degree more or less in 1976 and went to work at the newspaper then. And in fact, it was 40 years ago today that I was writing about the startup of oil flow in the pipeline. I remember it was there was a lot of anxiety about how things would go, and Dave might be better to speak to this, but you know, the start of the pipeline operation did not go smoothly. There were several problems, and E.L. Patton, who was the head of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, said that really there were human problems in the first few months of pipeline operations, and it just this transition just took time. The biggest problem, of course, was the explosion of Pump Station 8 outside of Fairbanks, which was a real a tragedy. But Alyeska overcame that and got things worked out more or less by the end of that summer. I'm not sure what Dave probably remembers something about that very well.
Well, and Dave, if you would just sort of set the scene for us, let's get, you know, starting from the beginning, the scale of the project as it eventually ramped up. Just describe for us what that was like, that massive event.
Well, when I first started on the haul road construction in early spring of 74, it was a massive earth-moving exercise. And ultimately, we mined and distributed over 70 million cubic yards of gravel between the haul road construction and the work pad that goes parallel and is along the pipeline route. So that's the way it began. And as I mentioned, I was at Five Mile Camp when that activity was started. And that was going on simultaneously from all the camps that were north of the Yukon. So we had a dozen or more construction camps that had to be populated, and all that heavy iron had to be brought into play, and a massive earth-moving exercise that started it all. Then in the late fall, it started to convert from a gravel hauling and mining operation to an actual pipe lining operation. And that was when we first attempted and began using the equipment necessary to build the above-ground pipeline. And that's the major technical hurdle that the project had to overcome, was that it ultimately ended up being over half of the pipeline that had to be elevated. That was new technology that had never been done before on a cross-country pipeline, and there was a huge learning curve associated with educating all of the folks, starting right from the engineering side of it as well as through all the construction skills that were required. The pace of all of this was really massive. And we used to talk amongst ourselves that we were living on a day-by-day basis for 2 days of a regular lifestyle would decompress into one, just because of the sheer magnitude of the effort, the pace things were going on, and the necessity to make decisions on the spot. There was not time to do more in-depth analysis. We had to just react very quickly to a lot of changed conditions.
And you know, Lori, I might chime in there with something. That really, this sense of the hectic pace, that really spilled over into life, particularly in Fairbanks and also in Valdez.
I want to talk about that in just a moment, but I just want to remind folks that if they're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing the beginning. Today is the first day of oil flow 40 years ago in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We're talking about that with people who have a great deal of knowledge about that. Dave Haugen was the manager for Alyeska at that time of this massive project. And Dermot Cole is on the line from Fairbanks. He is the author of Amazing Pipeline Stories, How Building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Transformed Life in America's Last Frontier. I'm holding up for the camera so that people on 360 North, when they watch this, can see the book. So,
you know, I've always hated the title of that book. It wasn't my idea. I thought that there'll be a sequel. It would be like even more amazing.
I mean, it does sound a little tabloidy, and well, it's not written that way. That's what was interesting.
I don't like the title, but you know, that was the publisher's idea. So,
yeah.
I just wanted to briefly say that if the pace of activity on the pipeline was exceptionally hectic, so was life in Fairbanks and Valdez at that time, and it made Fairbanks, I wouldn't say unlivable, but it made it unpleasant for many thousands of people because of the influx of construction workers and hangers-on and, you know, people who were out to sort of cause trouble.
And how quickly did that happen? How quickly did the city transform into this boom town?
Well, after oil was discovered, the pipeline was announced in fairly short order. And in one of the best decisions that was made by the oil companies, they ordered the pipe from Japan. And so it was delivered and sat in the storage yards in Fairbanks, Valdez, and at Prudhoe for 4 years, I think. But the project, it was immediately slowed down by a variety of factors. Mm. There were court issues, congressional delay, and regulatory issues with the federal government. And at the time, this seemed really interminable. And Fairbanks did not, because of this delay and this sort of short attention span of politics, Fairbanks did not really prepare for the transportation and the population influx that occurred. So in the end, by 1974, the phone system was virtually useless in Fairbanks, and its utilities were really maxed out and strained. Mm. The traffic, it was much worse than it is in, you know, any place in Alaska today, because just the roads didn't exist to handle the vehicles. And Alyeska ordered everything in yellow. I'm not sure why. All the trucks were in yellow, and they became sort of the source of frustration of people in Fairbanks who had old pickup trucks. And here Alyeska had these brand new yellow Chevy pickup trucks.
Truck envy.
Anyway, it was extremely hectic, stressful period maybe for the community. I just wanted to just maybe say a couple things about this. In a way, the pipeline is a victory for the environmental movement in the United States. Now, that's a strange thing to say, and I know people on all sides of this will probably reject that thinking, but this was the first real project that took place after the passage of the law that created the Environmental Protection Agency. And it became a big test for the Nixon administration and for the federal government. And the standards forced on the pipeline builders through the EPA and other government regulatory agencies, I think, made the project better. And it's one reason why it's lasted this long and withstood, you know, all sorts of difficulties and challenges. But having said all that, it's my opinion that the pipeline should have been built through Canada. Now, at the time, everyone in Alaska wanted to build in Alaska. But I guess I agree with the late Jay Hammond, our former governor, who said it was maybe one of the most costly mistakes of the 20th century. because of the high transportation costs associated with shipping the oil to Valdez and then tankering it to the lower 48 and then across the country. Anyway, that's a lot of ground to cover there.
I'm sure Dave
has an opinion on this.
You're just throwing the bombs right out there, right off the bat, Dermot. So let's go to the phones for just a moment. Jude is in Fairbanks. Hi, Jude.
Hi. And hi, Dave.
Hi, Jude. I haven't heard your feed in a long, many, many years here.
There you go. I got your business card. Are you still with the gas line project?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'll get a hold of you when I get to Anchorage.
Good.
All right. Well, it's a little early in the discussion, but I was at the oil. Dave and I worked on that original survey that he's talking about, for one thing. But I was there in Valdez for the oil in party. And I don't know how many were there, Dave. Several thousand, a thousand, a lot of people.
Yes, there were.
And then management provided drinks and food. And there was one table for food, and there was one table for the drinks. And the lines were unending. I was just a sarcastic person might say, "Well, this is typical of the planning that went into this pipeline," but. It was pretty funny to me. It looked like that gold rush scene going up the mountain with all the lines of traffic. That's it. I don't have any more, but yeah, nice discussion.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Jude. And Dave, did you want to jump in after Dermot threw out those hand grenades about the environmental policy and where the pipeline should have gone in his estimation?
Well, maybe a few comments on the things that I'm maybe halfway qualified to talk about. Certainly, like Dermot said, it was the first major project under the new NEPA world that we were put into. And because of that, a lot of the rules were not clear as to the regulatory oversight. And yes, I think that there were many good things that came of that. But there were also, because of the confusion factor on how to implement some of the regulations and some of the other activities that went along with it, there was some large costs that can be attributed to that. Mm. For instance, there was a requirement to build a fairly significant number of animal crossings on the pipeline because there were some folks that said that animals would not cross beneath an elevated pipeline. Well, we found out after it was constructed that, yes, they will. And had that not been a requirement, a significant amount of cost wouldn't have had to been incurred.
Yeah, but Dave, do you think that no one knew that, right?
I was just going to say that. How would you know, right?
That's the problem when you have – when you're a project proponent, you are given someone's opinion, shall we say, and then if there's no proof to the contrary, then you must go ahead and execute on that basis.
Right.
That becomes the policy.
Yes.
After the fact, though, you can't get that money back. The money has to be spent. And
it's certainly true. The environmental groups, or many of them, wanted – no pipeline. That was what they wanted to stop entirely. And so, you know, some of the obstructions maybe were thrown up. Well, they did come about through that, a point of view. But, you know, the original pipeline idea was to have 90% of it buried. Now, I and the oil companies have always said that had they gotten further in the engineering design, they would have abandoned that original idea just as they did when the USGS said they should. To reach the situation that transpired, which was to have about half of it above ground and half below ground. Was that the major challenge of this project, going half above ground and half below ground?
Well, it certainly added significant cost to the project. There's many a discussion about how much the pipeline changed from its original estimate to what actually it cost at the completion of it all. But another factor that really created difficulties with the whole above ground system was even in spite of a massive amount of geotechnical investigations that went on prior to construction starting, we still found as we were digging the trench, for instance, to bury the pipe, we would come across undetected permafrost conditions, at which time, at the very 11th hour, we had to do what we called a remode, which was to convert the buried pipeline to an above-ground project. And that occurred throughout the entire time we were constructing the project. That created a tremendous logistical problem because the materials it takes to elevate the pipeline, the VSMs, the cross beams, and the shoes and all the fittings, as well as all the insulation, had to be brought in at the 11th hour, which was a very big problem for us.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the start of the flow of oil that started 40 years ago today and the building of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, an enormous engineering feat. We're talking with Dave Haugen, who was one of the early managers on the job right from the very beginning, worked for Alyeska Pipeline Company, and also on the line from KUAC in Fairbanks is Dermot Cole, a journalist and author of Amazing Pipeline Stories. We are going to go back to the phones for a moment. William is in Wasilla.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I worked in Fairbanks for security during construction, and there were so many people up there in Fairbanks cashing checks. I went to the bank with my payroll check and couldn't cash it. None of the banks had any money because everybody cashed checks. So what they would do is give you a bank draft. So that's when I decided I joined the credit union up there, and I could get my paycheck automatically deposited into my account, and then I didn't have to worry about cashing it. But I thought that was rather strange to see all these big long lines going into the bank. And they had no money, no cash.
Wow.
You know, that reminds me of a comment that a bank president made. It might have been Frank Murkowski. I'm not sure, but it was a joke that, and I have it in my book, that bank tellers who stayed at least 30 days were given diamond seniority pins.
I mean, 30 days, yikes.
Well, it was a joke. Well, it was a joke. But I mean, because there was turnover in every job that did not pay well. It was an immense turnover. And that was one of the problems I had with the banks. I hadn't heard about running out of cash, but there were long lines at every bank on payday and interminable waits. That helped lead to the people quitting those jobs and trying to get on the pipeline, because most people wanted to stay in Fairbanks as little as possible and then get a job in the pipeline.
Let's stay with the phones for just a moment, and then let's talk about some more of those logistics. Bill is in Anchorage. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, good morning. I helped build the haul road to Prudhoe Bay, and it took us 6 months. And then I helped build taps and babysit the line from Prudhoe Bay down the Valdez, and now I'm retired. But my question is, I think we probably pumped, 22, 23 billion barrels of oil from those fields up north? So my question is, why is it we have so little? You look at Norway, they have $1 trillion in their per PFD, we have so little, which is 57 billion. Who got the money? And what's strange is we sent a bunch of legislatures over to Norway to look at what they do, and they came back and they put on a thing at the Anchorage Museum, and I sat through it, and what I came out of it is why we have so little. Even under ACES, the oil companies made more money.
Well, Bill, I'm going to tell you,
in the world.
Thanks for the call, but we are going to stick with construction. That's a question for another day, the politics of what happens with the money that is derived from the oil that flows through the line is a political question
Lori,
for another day.
Lori, can I just like a five-second answer
sure,
to this?
One, absolutely.
One of the key differences. Norway did not eliminate its taxes. That is one of the essential.
Yeah, that is definitely. They tax at a pretty healthy rate in Norway, and that's one of the big reasons why they have such a large sovereign wealth fund. Let's talk a little about more of the logistics. You know, we just heard a caller a few moments ago talk about long lines at the bank. What else? What was the scale, this massive scale of this project, Dave? You were there. What how was it to get these supplies, food, all of the needs that you had into these very remote areas where there was no infrastructure? How was that accomplished?
Well, it was a very significant problem, as you can imagine. And it starts with the idea you have to house all the people along the route. So we had to construct a whole series of construction camps all the way from Valdez to Prudhoe Bay. Now, some of those had had a earlier start. Some of the camps were north of the Yukon that had been put in place in the 1970, early 70s time frame. But all the camps in the south of Yukon had to be created from scratch. And in some cases, they were pretty sizable. The Isabel Pass camp was over 1,600 beds. So these are not small little things to put together. They have to have complete sewage and water treatment facilities, electrical generation, recreational halls. Of course, the most important part of all is the kitchen and the mess hall part of it. So just getting those camps established is a major logistical exercise. And they have to be put in place because you have to house the people who are going to actually do the work from that point forward. The other thing is just all the materials. The pipe itself had to be distributed, like Dermot said, from the major stockpiles that were in place at Valdez and Fairbanks and at Prudhoe Bay. That had to be redistributed along the pipeline route. And then finally you had to mobilize all of the people and equipment to do the actual pipelining activities. A lot of that equipment originated from the lower 48 states and other places around the world. And we aren't talking much about other big pieces of equipment that were part of the pump stations themselves, and then, of course, the terminal as well as at Valdez, which was a major exercise all by itself. So logistics is a huge part of any of these projects and creates a significant amount of cost. The other thing it does is once it's in place, the daily cost of keeping that operational is very large and creates problems if you lose any construction sequencing or things of that sort. A lot of those costs continue on no matter what.
We're going to take just a quick break. Today's Talk of Alaska is part of a larger series at Alaska Public Media on the pipeline called Midnight Oil, including a new podcast that launches today. To hear the incredible story of how Prudhoe Bay was discovered, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe to Midnight Oil wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back in just a moment as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from...
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the building of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The oil started flowing today, 40 years ago. You can join our conversation if you helped build the pipeline, if you were either on the crew or maybe lived in the area and saw the big boom that happened during that construction phase. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Philip is in Anvik. Hi, Philip.
Hi.
Did you have a story for us?
Yes, I joined the Union 302 operating engineers in May 1974. Hello?
Hello, we're listening.
Yeah, and I got to work all the way up from Poudre Bay down to Isabel Pass, and then I got shipped up to Pump 1 to put in gathering lines. And I got about 17,500 hours in there.
Wow.
And I'm retired now.
That's definitely a lot of hours. Dave, that was one of the questions that I had. Thanks so much for the call, Philip. I had a question about the fact that there was a big push to build fast. Why was that? What was that about?
Well, you have to keep in mind that the oil was first discovered in 1968, the original discovery well. And then from that point forward, there was a huge amount of cost associated with just the field development part of that. And then along came the pipeline itself to try to get the oil moved down and finally go to the marketplace. So from 1968 until today, 40 years ago, that entire time frame, not one of the owner companies was making any money whatsoever off of that huge amount of investment. So by the time the pipeline was coming to a close, it was very important to get it flowing as soon as possible because the owners had had to raise all that money by bank loans and other financing mechanisms.
Sure.
To be able to finance all of that. And it came close. I mean, there were rumors that some of the companies were very close to almost declaring bankruptcy had not the oil started to flow on a timely basis.
So you had this great pressure on you as a manager to get stuff done quickly. Usually speed introduces problems. Accidents can happen. What sort of nightmares, headaches did that cause for you, this push to go faster?
Well, we certainly were never encouraged to try to do anything to shortcut any safety concerns. That was mandatory that we would abide by all the safety regulations in place. Another thing we would not do would be to short circuit when required the environmental requirements that were put in place. That was also a given. But there was still a real pressure on us to try to incentivize the workers to get the projects done. So some of the tools available, of course, obviously, is just to work longer hours or double shift operations, and that certainly came into play. But keep in mind the standard work week along the right-of-way was a 7-day-a-week, 12-hour-a-day work schedule, and then a rotational schedule of 8 weeks on and 2 weeks off.
Wow.
So there was very intense pressure as well on the workers. Of course, to most folks, they were happy with that because it generated some fairly significant size paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what attracted a large number of people to the project to begin with.
Dermot,
Dermot Cole,
do you want to weigh in here a little bit about
sure.
the speed?
A couple things about that. First of all, if you look back, there's some interesting political things that occurred in 1973 that really changed the course of history on this. By a one-vote margin in July of 73, the U.S. Senate approved a plan that basically said the environmental objections are cleared and the project can go ahead. Of course, it was later that fall that the first big OPEC oil embargo occurred. Now, that led to great political pressure to get this project done as well. So in 74, when the real construction started and was completed in 3 years, is an incredibly fast period of time, really, when you look back on it. That pressure was not only political, but it was economic, as Dave said, because the oil companies would not be making any money, recovering any of their investment
sure.
until oil started flowing. So it was pressure from all, you know, it was both political and economic. Now, one aspect of this I think is worth noting is that you talk to anybody who worked on the pipeline or just about anybody who was a union hand, they will talk about how they have some stories about sitting on a bus all day and doing nothing. So I'd like Dave maybe to address that a little bit. I mean, it seemed to me that maybe Alyeska had more than enough people for a given task because that played into the timing of you have to do things in a certain order, and it's better to have more than enough people than to have too few people.
Certainly, I can try to address that. And yes, there were times when there was a certain amount of lack of productivity in individual situations. But again, you have to keep in mind, like I said earlier, on the sheer cost of putting all this system together in terms of all the camps, the support that's behind that, the daily cash burn that is ongoing is phenomenal. Now, if the choices were to dispatch a crew out there where they could get maybe some production done, but not 100%, sometimes that was a judgment call that we would make just purely because, again, of the schedule pressure that was under to try to complete it on time. So there's reasons why things happen. Another thing is that we were dependent upon field notices to proceed from the regulatory oversight that was ongoing. And in some cases, you know, we would come up against a certain lack of permits that would disrupt the construction sequence. And that was a very costly thing. And again, that would occur when the construction crews were already out there along the right-of-way.
And suddenly you'd have a job holdup for
approval of
certain
things. Yeah, so there were reasons why. Now, it's a less than perfect world, and certainly, you know, there were times when the productivity was what we weren't hoping for. Don't forget about the weather. We ran this operation for 3 years on a year-round basis, including some very difficult times during the dead of winter at extremely cold temperatures and wind chill conditions. But again, it was required to do so in order to maintain the construction schedule.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment and get some callers in here. Dave is in Anchor Point. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. Good morning, Lori. I was born and raised in Fairbanks back in the mid-50s, and it was just a wonderful place to be a kid and to grow up. And I always figured I'd grow old and die in Fairbanks. And then the pipeline came along, and I was 20 and when I first got hired on. And I worked from Blackwater Bend south of Delta up to Prudhoe Bay over the years. And that was quite an experience. The pipeline was just a huge effort. It was like mobilizing for World War II or something like that. But what I saw the influx of people do to Fairbanks made me not want to live there anymore. You know, downtown Second Avenue was full of drunks and hookers and drugs, and it was not a very healthy place to live at the time. So I had a high school buddy who had made a little bit of money on the pipeline like I did. I didn't work it as hardcore as many people did. But we made enough money to come down to Kenai Peninsula in Anchor Point and buy a piece of property, and that's where I live now, which is very nice. The pipeline definitely was one of the big movers and changers of what Alaska used to be into what Alaska is now.
Absolutely.
But, it was a great experience, but and I still love Fairbanks. Don't get me wrong there. I have family up there still. But I couldn't live there during when the pipeline was going on.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave, for that call. There's a very clear illustration from a former resident who felt like the activity just drove him right out of the city. Let's stay with the phones for just a moment. Michelle is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I work at the terminal in Valdez, and at the peak of construction, we were feeding 3,500 people. It was quite a unique experience in several ways. For example, the kitchen crew work 7 days a week. The rest of the worker work 6 days a week because Valdez was just close by. So it was a lunch for a brown bag for the lunch and a dinner with three different types of entree and as much meat or fish as you wanted to eat. It was one person who was cutting with three slicers the cold cuts for 10 hours every night. That lady was feeding the slicer, packing the meat, slicing. That's all what she was doing.
Oh, my goodness.
7 days a week. For breakfast, we took some garbage cans, clean one, brand new in those days. And we had three of those full garbage cans, like what they are, 35, 40 gallons, full of eggs. We put the hakes down the big mixer, and then now, of course, the health department would flip over that, and then broke the shell, put the hakes through a strainer, and filled those three garbage cans, and every day, they were gone for omelets, or French toast, or whatever else was needed. I mean, when you cook, let's say, a stew, you had one of those flatbed carts like you find at Costco, and that one was full of meat, and the second one was full of canned goods, and the third one was some fresh vegetables.
Wow.
I mean, it was just some dimensions. When you move, you cook, you move tons every day, tons of product you move, from moving it to the cooking pot, to putting it into the pan, to putting it in line. I mean, it was just an incredible. It was a time when most of the workers never had that type of quality of food that was served to them.
What an amazing story to have three garbage cans. I mean, just the image of that. Thanks so much for that memory and talking to us about slicing the poor woman slicing meat for 10 hours at a time. I want to go back a bit to the speed logistics aspect of it. The master in all this was the late Frank Moulin. He was the senior project manager of the pipeline. He is, in a lot of descriptions, a legendary figure. So, Dave, let's start with you and describe him. Who was Frank? What was he like to work with?
Well, actually, I really am deeply indebted to Frank. He's the person that actually hired me in 1974 when I first came on board with Alyeska. And Frank had a career by that time around the world on different projects, refinery in Singapore. He was part of the BART system in San Francisco when that was being constructed. And like I say, he was the guy that started up the project from the pipeline portion of it, and I reported directly to him. He was a leader amongst leaders. Mm-hmm. He was a very demanding but fair person that could really articulate the objectives. And then he was insistent upon you being able to follow with him on the objective. And it was a time when, as I mentioned earlier, the pace of activities were such that there was no time for any kind of retraining or anything like that. Some of us that were hired on were thrown at activities and given responsibilities were far beyond anything we'd ever dealt with before. But Frank's attitude was that he expected us to succeed and that he would be with us if we did so. But the one unforgivable sin would be to ever step backwards. Well, that was not in the way that the project would have to be advanced. So he's largely responsible for the reason that the pipeline came online on schedule.
Dermot Cole, did you want to weigh in a bit on Frank Moulin?
Actually, yeah, Laura, I did. And Dave, I'm glad you brought that up. The Alaska legislature named the Yukon River Bridge after E.L. Patton, who was the head of Alyeska. But as far as I know, I don't think they ever named anything after Frank Moulin. And, you know, that bridge would be better named, as far as I'm concerned, after Moulin and not Patton. Although, you know, Patton was, as a chief executive, had a great deal of political power. In my book, I quoted a guy named Dave Hagen, who said he once got to the office at 4 o'clock in the morning just to try to be there before Frank Moulin. And when Moulin showed up at 4:30 in the morning, you exchanged greetings. But, Dave, you said that you could tell it really bothered Frank that someone had beaten him to the office.
Yeah, that's a true story.
That's
great.
There was a story in the Engineering News Record, and it said, this was the quote, he demands total dedication, saying, your wife had a baby? So what? Anyway, he was named.
He was a tough character. Named, he's a tough
well,
taskmaster.
I don't think, well, given these conditions,
yes,
given this pressing deadline. There was no real time to waste on this. That I can understand why you'd have to have a really a taskmaster of that of that sort.
Absolutely.
And I think maybe he said it and others said it. No individual person could understand this project. Right? It was too vast, and you know, people maybe understood parts of it. And actually, Dave, I'm interested what you think about this. No one could understand the entire thing. This is just complexity beyond anything probably that had certainly happened in Alaska, and really, you know, one of the most challenging engineering projects in the world.
I totally agree with that, Dermot. In fact, I can recall when I was first thrown at it in the field when I went to Five Mile Camp and we began the construction of the haul road. And I was unfortunately not given any briefing whatsoever to prepare for that. And when I got off the airplane in Five Mile and started to try to see my way around and determine what my role was supposed to be, I was literally on my own to try to figure it out. And what I observed around me was this frantic pace of all kinds of things going on. And I really had to do my own little self-evaluation after a while and recognize that there were things that were beyond my control to deal with. But at the same time, if they were within my control, it was my responsibility to deal with that. But you're absolutely correct. Those are, you can multiply that times 800 miles with all the activities ongoing. And we did have people come to the project that tried to function in different capacities and just couldn't handle the sheer stress and strain of getting in those situations and having to deal with it and make decisions where there was no way to know if they were proper at the time, but you had to make the decision and live with the consequences right after that.
I want to get back to Frank Mullen. Dermot, you had mentioned that you thought the Yukon River Bridge should have been named after him. And we have a caller on the line right now. William is in Fairbanks, who has a comment about the Yukon River Bridge. Not sure what it is, but hi, William.
Howdy. I had worked on the Yukon River Bridge there in the course of the, I believe it was the third pier. They were driving the cofferdam around the for foundation, dewater it, and discovered there wasn't any refusal on about a third of the perimeter. And on further the investigation, it was determined it was on a fault, which was determined to be an inactive fault, last having moved something like 40,000 years ago. And so they redesigned the, expanded the footing on it, and it's gone on its merry way ever since. I have a couple other comments. One was as far as facts and figures. As I understand it, there was 70,000 people total worked on the project, but the peak employment, there was about 20,000 people in the various camps. Another thing maybe you could point out there is the pipeline was divided into, I believe it was five sections that were competitively bid by and awarded to five different construction entities. People a lot of times say it was a cost plus project, but my understanding is just the haul road was built on a cost plus basis. There was all sorts of increases in cost on the rest of it, but it was just the haul road was built on a cost plus basis. And when I worked on the bridge there, the 5 mile camp was still under the cost plus regimen there. So for Sunday meal, they had the surf and turf, the classic steak and lobster. Whereas on the Yukon River Bridge camp there, that we just had a choice of prime rib or steak. I'll hang up with somebody else. Come.
Wow, that's all, prime rib or steak. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more questions, more calls, and more conversation with Dave Haugen and Dermot Cole about the start of the flow of oil in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline that started today, 40 years ago.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from...
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the start of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And Dermot, in your book, Amazing Pipeline Stories, you wrote that during the peak of construction, there was about 24,000 or so people working, a staggering number at one time, and about 2,800 of them were women. Talk a little bit about that, and then Dave, I'd like your thoughts too. What did they tell you about that experience?
Well, actually, there's different statistics, and I've probably in that same book, there may be more than one. There may be a conflicting number there. I think the peak employment, I think, may have been the fall of 75, about 28,000, with a total maybe of 70,000 people between 1969 and 1977. As far as women were concerned, remember, this happened right at the time when the Equal Rights Amendment was being promoted and mm-hmm. the women's rights movement was taking hold. And so that really provided a spur, as well as Congress, to open the construction fields to women. And for many women, this was sort of their, you know, initiation to it. And in a lot of cases, it was there was one woman and 800 men in, you know, I mean, very few women, large numbers of men. It put them under a lot of pressure, and again, this started from, you know, the idea of at these remote construction camps originally was no women, no drugs and no alcohol. Right. Well,
Dave,
no women thing was tossed out because of changing societal pressures.
And Dave, what kind of logistical situations did that create? Was it problematic or did it go fairly well?
Well, actually, I can recall when, in particular, the pipeline welders, the local 798ers that are based out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, were informed federally that they would have to open up their ranks to women. And I can remember the group that came around to each one of the construction camps, addressing the hands that were there in each one of the camps and explaining to them that this was not a optional situation any longer, that they would be employing women and as helpers and maybe even qualifying them as welders. It was, as you can imagine, for some folks there, not well received. It was an uphill battle, but it was a mandate. Now, I agree with Dermot. There was not a large number of women employed, but we did have accommodations that were required to be in place in each one of the camps. And, there was no shortage of issues that went along with that.
I want to go to a couple of emails here. Karen says that she remembers getting stuck behind trucks taking 80-foot lengths of pipe going up the old Stees Highway. She also remembers random shortages of things like duct tape and bug spray missing from the shelves of hardware stores in Fairbanks. But she had a question. She said, can you please talk about the explosion at the pump station down by Delta? And another email question that maybe we can combine with her question about the explosion was, Lee from Haines sent in a question about how many people died during construction.
I can address the situation with Pump Station 8 as Dermot relayed. At that point in time, the oil had started to flow just like we're commemorating today on June 20th. And as the oil front was moving down the pipeline route, there was work that was preceding that was necessary, and there's a nitrogen purge that's in front of the oil front. When it came into the Pump Station 8 area, there had been some issues associated with some of the flows themselves, and some activities went on there that were later determined to be some operator error in terms of valves being opened that shouldn't have been open. Unfortunately, the controller that was there at the time noticed what was going on, ran back into the pump building and told everyone to evacuate. And ironically, he was the one fatality that came from that explosion. And it was very unfortunate loss of life.
Were there other fatalities?
Oh, yes. There were fatalities along the road and the route. A lot of those were what I would call vehicular fatalities. Again, because as your email person was talking about, we were hauling pipe from the original pipe locations from Valdez, from Fairbanks, and from Prudhoe Bay, and they were made into double joints, which means you take two 40-foot joints, weld them together. So we were transporting 80-foot joints of pipe, and you know, people would try to pass those trucks at the wrong time, things of that sort. That's where a fairly significant number of fatalities were occurring.
We only have about a minute or so left, and Dermot, I wanted to get you in here for some final thoughts. I knew we should have made this a two-hour program because we barely touched the surface of this massive endeavor and also the lasting impacts on the economy and folks who came here and stayed. But Dermot, just kind of give us some final thoughts about this whole experience.
Well, I think in retrospect, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built to a high standard because of the design met the challenges. Of course, the system also included the tankers, and we know that the Exxon Valdez was the biggest disaster that occurred, and that was part of the system, but not part of the on-land project, which I think has been a success. Certainly changed the social and economic and political life of Alaska in dramatic ways, as we're still seeing today.
Absolutely. Dave, anything that you wanted to leave us with?
Well, for one that was part of that activity, I take great satisfaction all these years later in the impact that has created for the state of Alaska. Something like $160 billion of revenue has gone into the general fund of the state of Alaska. And for my family that I've got two sons, a daughter-in-law and a granddaughter, they've reaped the benefits of that work that's gone on into the state of Alaska from that day forward.
Well, thank you so much to my guests, Dave Haugen and Dermot Cole on the line from KUAC in Fairbanks. Dermot is the author of Amazing Pipeline Stories, How Building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Transformed Life in America's Last Frontier. And remember that you can get the new podcast, Midnight Oil. It's available right now. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network by
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
And by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.